Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. You can also find us on Facebook, and we stream live on the web at kzyx.org. Coming up is Wild Oak Living. Today we're going to be talking about love from now until noon, and then at noon it's fresh air, so please stay tuned for all of that. Support for KZYX comes from our members and Dirt Cheap Garden Supply in Fort Bragg, proudly celebrating their 16th year in Mendocino County, offering laboratory-tested, clean, microbrewed, and all-organic potting soils, composts, and fertilizers. Buy the truckload in totes, large and small, and bags. Available in Fort Bragg or by delivery in Mendocino, Humboldt, Lake, and Sonoma, and beyond. More information and delivery scheduling is at 964-4211. Stay tuned for Wild Oak Living. Welcome to Wild Oak Living here on KZYX, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. This is Johanna Wild Oak, and I bring you this program every other Thursday now from 11 o'clock until noon. It rotates with the Cannabis Hour. This program is all about living, working, and having fun sustainably in Mendocino County and beyond. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, if you have feedback or questions or program suggestions, or would like me to tell you about any of the websites and information that was quoted on the program, you can easily get in touch with me by sending me an email at contact@wildoak.org. That's contact@wildoak.org. Today, we're going to be talking about love. This is actually a program that I had scheduled originally for Valentine's Day, and we had to reschedule it for important reasons. But I'm so happy today to welcome back the author of a book called Power of Love, A Transformed Heart Changes the World. And of course, now you can guess why we had scheduled that program for Valentine's Day. Fran Grace is the author of the book, and the book reveals many ways to tap into one of the most powerful yet overlooked resources on the planet, the human capacity to love. It takes readers on a wide-ranging journey, for example, into Buddhist and Hindu monasteries, an indigenous grandmother's fire circle, and the laboratory of a Stanford physicist. The author interviews teachers familiar with slave dungeons in Ghana and near-death experiences and many more. Join us for this conversation today, and if we have time, we're going to open up the phone lines towards this in the second half of the hour. For you to share your thoughts and questions. Welcome, Fran Grace, to Wild Oak Living.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
Wonderful. Let me give our listeners a little bit of a background about you. I'm just going to read what's in the back of your book. Fran Grace is professor of religious studies and founding steward of the meditation program at the University of Redlands in California, where she has pioneered a intergenerational approach to university education since 2004. Recognition for her teaching and research into spiritual life has included appearances on C-SPAN and NPR, a Pew Fellowship from Yale University, a Luce Fellowship in Comparative Religion and Theology, and many teaching awards. After receiving her PhD in 1997 from Princeton Theological Seminars, she wrote a book called Carry a Nation, Retelling the Life, which publishers Weekly named a landmark biography. In 2004, a life crisis opened a deeper interest in the existential and spiritual sides of life, and Fran then spent many years investigating the inner arts and sciences expressed in such publications as Meditation in the Classroom and the Classroom, which was co-edited with Judith Zimmer Brown, and A Semester Within, which is a documentary film, and numerous articles. Her quest was enriched by an unexpected encounter with a teacher who introduced her to a path of inner freedom that respects the foundational teachings of all spiritual traditions. In 2008, she founded the Institute for Contemplative Life, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to the inner pathway common to all religions. Before her teacher's death in 2012, she edited and wrote the foreword to this widely popular book, Letting Go, The Pathway of Surrender, by Dr. David R. Hawkins, who taught her love is both the means and the end. And it's the topic of our conversation today.
All right.
I don't know if you were able to hear that I explained we had to originally schedule to talk to you about this book on Valentine's Day for obvious reasons.
Right.
And so now we're exactly a month past Valentine's Day, but I think it's as apropos as ever.
It's perfect.
Yes.
To talk about love in March.
Exactly. And since you know, love is not something that you set aside one day of the year for. It's something that is ongoing.
Isn't it? How wonderful.
Right. There are so many things. I was driving over here and I was outlining the interview in my head because I'm one of those interviewers. I have a ton of questions in my head, but I usually don't make like a fixed agenda for the interview because
right.
I like serendipity to do its work and take us, wherever she wants to take us. And
it treated
more like a conversation over a cup of coffee as opposed to a scripted interview. And so there are, as I said, 100 questions in my head that I want to ask you about it, but I'd like to start by asking you the questions that I ask pretty much everybody, at least those who have written a book or made a film or something like that. What inspired you to write a book about the power of love? And also, how did you, maybe before you even get into that, how did you get onto this career path that you're on? I know,
well,
those are big questions.
Love is the hidden motivator behind anything that we do, even if we're not conscious of it. We become interested in something and driven by something from within, and we go for it. So for me, as a person in my 20s, in terms of the career path, I thought I was going to be getting a PhD in political science when I was in my 20s. It's not because I was consciously wanting to study the governmental ins and outs and policy and all that, but I loved my father, and out of love for my father, I wanted to study something and become something that I thought he would admire and appreciate. So we do so many things out of love for other people, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
But something had to shift for me, and it happened when I entered seminary unexpectedly and entered a Master of Divinity program, and then something got awakened from within, a love for the study of what we can't see, and really maybe what we can't even know. The reality, capital R. I had a professor who was an expert in the Christian mystics, and reading those texts, it like turned on a light switch in me that made me want to go deeper into the study of religious studies. I fell in love, you might say, with the study of these mystics, because to me, the mystics taught the message of love, love in many forms, love of our own life, love of creation, love of God, love of each other, love of humanity, and so I fell in love with the study of love through the eyes of these mystics. So that began a career path that I hadn't planned on, but has been sustainable for me. And I love your program is about sustainable living, because for me, this topic of love and the energy of love and a life of learning how to love is very sustainable. It's an energy that sustains us in times of crisis and in times of uncertainty and feeling down and out and discouraged. But if we have love for something, love for a plant, love for a pet, love for our work, love for a neighbor, we can get up the next day and keep going. So that's how I got on the career path, to answer your first question.
I don't know if this question fits right now, but it's just sort of popped to the top of my mind, so I'm going to ask it now. In your book, one of the underlying themes, at least to me when I read it, and everybody's going to take away something different when they read your book, I think, was that love, while it can be inspired by other people or by, mm-hmm. by teachers, in the end, it resides within you.
Exactly.
And to what extent, to what extent does that feeling, that love or whatever it is, have to be expressed in the interaction with other people to be there, to exist,
yeah,
to guide you?
That's a great question. I think many people may be like me, in the sense that I was always looking for love, as if it were outside of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, we go in search of love, and we try to find something. If I can get into this, then I'll have that experience of love and appreciation, and I'll get love back from other people in the form of approval and gratitude and applause or whatever. This longing to be regarded as a lovable person and an appreciated person. I was in search of something outside of myself. And my teacher, Dr. David Hawkins, one of the first things he said to me, which I didn't understand at the time, I was in my 30s, he said, "You yourself are what you're looking for." Mm-hmm. And I didn't know I had a capacity for love inside of me, and I didn't quite understand what he meant. And it took his death and this process of writing the book by going around the world and interviewing people who he verified had a capacity to teach me about love, because they actually had gotten to a place of living from that inner core of love within their own being. And that was very powerful, just to be with people who are loving. And so that interaction, I think the interaction that we have with each other is each interaction, whether it's with a human being or an animal or the air or the water or a tree, any interaction between living things has the potential to evolve us and open us if we have that way of looking at it in the moment.
I'm just wondering, could you be a hermit living in a cave and still be filled with love?
Absolutely. I think this is the case, for example, of one of the people I interviewed for the book, Tenzin Palmo, a Buddhist nun who spent 12 years in a Himalayan cave, 13,000 feet up, alone. Basically for 12 years, and yet she went there in a pursuit of love, out of love for her guru who guided her to take this retreat, and she felt the presence of love in the form of her guru, in the form of nature and deities and bodhisattvas, as she was there alone in that cave. So obviously we're sitting alone, and as soon as we think of someone we love, there's the feeling of love right there already within. And according to my teacher and many other mystics, love is a radiation, just like gravity. You know, we don't see gravity. We don't feel like it's really hitting on us or moving us around. However, it's because of this invisible force that radiates. Everything is kept in balance. And he taught me that because love radiates from the hearts of loving people, the world is kept in balance.
Do we need other people or other beings or other energy that's outside of us to teach us love, or do you think we come like that?
Well, I think it's both and. I think in my own experience, that's all I can talk about. Mm-hmm. I understand that there was the substance of love. I mean, how can anything be created unless it's or exist without love inside of it? Love is what grows something. So there's love inside, but I wasn't in touch with it. You know, most of us aren't born into unconditionally loving families where we're encouraged and opened up. We're often criticized and judged, and in my case, it was a Southern family that had very set ideas about what a little girl was supposed to do and talk and be like, and so I became very constricted as a human being. And it wasn't until my 30s in a love affair where, and often it's a romantic love affair that first awakens that great feeling of there's something beyond me, myself. And I learned about love through a human love affair first.
Mm-hmm. Your book, the subtitle of your book is A Transformed Heart. Changes the world, and basically, if I look at the outline of your book, and by the way, it's 10/11/16, so let me take a moment to let our listeners know that this is Wild Oak Living on KZYX, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, and this is Johanna Wild Oak, and I bring you this program every other Thursday from 11 until noon. Today, my guest is Fran Grace, and she is the author of a book called The Power of Love, A Transformed Heart Changes the World. And if I look at the outline of the book, and I like looking, when I interview authors, I like looking at the outline because I think, there's a reason why you lay out your book the way you do and why things happen in a certain sequence. And it kind of provides me with an overview of what you're trying to present. So you start... It's basically four parts. Part one is searching for love. Part two is finding love. And then part three is being transformed by love. And part four is surrendering to love. And I'm wondering, what I would really enjoy doing is if we can actually use this as a little guide for what to talk about, because I would like us to walk with you through that process of searching, finding, being transformed, and surrendering. And maybe you share in each of those chapters, you share stories of your encounter with people. And by the way, this 1 hour radio program isn't going to even scratch the surface of all the wonderful stories that you tell in this book. So, if anything, even if you're not interested in sort of the overall spiritual theme, just reading the stories is wonderful because you really describe the people so well that you encounter along the way. And you talk about, what you learned from them, but also what they learned in being who they are. And so this is a really interesting storybook in addition to being a book about love. And I enjoyed it as that very much. So I'm wondering if maybe we could pick a couple of highlights of each of those parts. So, to take us through this process that you describe in the book. Mm-hmm. Let's start with searching for love.
Well, we search for something because we think we'll find it. So already the search means that a person has probably in childhood or teenage years become aware that there's something very beautiful about life. Maybe they caught it in a glimpse, or a connection with a family pet early on. Some people have very difficult childhoods. I mean, we're all so wounded in a way because of the criticalness of families and limitations of our culture. But in every human life, early on, there's some moment where a person realizes, wow, there is something good about life. There's, the love of a grandparent, mm-hmm. or for some people who are more introverted, a quiet moment by themselves in the woods. I've had in my classes, in the meditation class that I teach with college students, the first exercise I ask them to do is just think about your life and what was the moment where you had the greatest peace and feeling about yourself and life. And it's so diverse what they write about. And so then we go in search of that, having known that it's something good exists in ourselves and in life. We want to connect with that, so we go in search of it. And so for me, I went in search of it through, I guess, both in personal love, falling in love, and having love connections with friends, and going to places I love. I talk about how I spent a couple of years in Florence, Italy. What a beautiful place. I mean, there are places that really awaken that feeling within us of something so beautiful and exquisite about life. Great art and great culture.
Great
so that
food.
Search takes us to so many different places. For some of us, it takes us into a religion, or a spiritual path, or a vocational path. I think of Jane Goodall, who early on had dreams of where she was supposed to be, and ended up there in a life of great love for her work. And so that search takes us... it takes us where it takes us. There's no judgment because we're searching for something really that is maybe the most beautiful dimension of life.
You talk about, you just mentioned Florence as one of the places where you went during that
mm-hmm.
period. You also talk about encounters. I particularly love the quote that you have in this chapter where you talk about your work in Florence. Cracks are how the light gets in. Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison that also had a similar quote? I'm forgetting.
I believe it's Leonard Cohen.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That kind type of quote has made the rounds, but it all describes, you know, a similar concept of imperfection and brokenness is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yes, and I was such a constricted person because by that point in my early 20s, I had joined a fundamentalist religious sect that was very negating of the body, very negating of my own sort of being a woman, was very oppressive. We weren't allowed to talk, express ourselves. It had a very exclusivist dogmatism. I mean, I was there to convert people. I mean, that was a missionary trip, you know, right mm-hmm. versus wrong, that kind of thing. So, I mean, my goodness, I was basically living in a prison as a being. But yet, being in certain place, even a constricted person who's so shut down can be with a certain person or in a certain environment of beauty, and something can get in, and a light can get in those cracks.
There's two beautiful little vignettes that you describe. One of them is, and I've forgotten the name of the culture, where they use gold to fill in the cracks mm-hmm. in porcelain.
Right.
And the Navajo Japanese. Blankets mm-hmm. that have imperfections woven in mm-hmm. as a place where the creator can enter.
Yes, so that Rumi quote, the wound is where the light enters in. I mean, mm-hmm. this, and my own teacher said that our defects are doorways to grace and the infinite. So we like to hide or be ashamed of what we don't like in ourselves or what we've been told are faults or this or that, our own insecurities. But really, these are the places where something can come in and we are transformed. And that's been my experience. I now when I make mistakes, or like I did yesterday, you know, I was rushing around here and I wasn't present with a dear friend. And, you know, just looking at that moment of what was going on for me, you know, I'm driven, you know, and then to take a step back and say, wow, okay, she told me what the experience was to be with me when I'm so rushed and preoccupied, and it opened me up. and made me realize I got to slow down, make a change, and be more present.
It's interesting. How do I phrase that? You've incorporated some. Well, actually, you just described. I was just going to ask you how you've incorporated that in your life, but you just described how you do that by paying attention, and by allowing those moments of reflection and imperfection to teach you something. I guess.
Yeah, I think trying to be a loving person is loving. Love is all inclusive, so it includes our own well-being and our love for other people, especially the people that we live with and we're close with. You know, I have students that they're very driven to want to save the world, and they want to go across the world, you know, and do some great work. And yet the teaching of Mother Teresa and other some of the other people in the book is to, well, first love the people you're with.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give them the benefit of the doubt day by day? Can you withdraw your presumption that you think you know everything about them? You know, they're becoming something, like the beautiful flower in your garden. I mean, they're not always going to be exactly as you've presumed them. Just let them grow. Let them become before your very eyes. And, you know, love is open. Love doesn't impose.
You talk about the difference between, and I think you just mentioned it, between doing good work and being a loving person, or being a good person. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that, because often one encounters people who, you know, who want to do good, but who aren't very loving people to be with. Let me put it this way.
I describe in the book how I was a do-gooder at first. I guess you would say, from a strong right-wing religious background, a do-gooder, doing good, as defined by that faith, being virtuous, going to church three times a week, doing, you know, moral, taking the moral straight and narrow path. You know, we didn't dance, we weren't allowed to dance, we weren't allowed to cuss, we weren't allowed to drink, have sex. You know, that was do-goodism. That was doing good, according to that paradigm. But there was no love in it.
Yeah.
There was no love in it. It was all right and wrong and moralism. And really, when you get down to it, it was the egotistical effort to try to reach heaven and get approval of the church members. And then on the other side, I also, when I left the church, then I did do-goodism according to a left-wing political paradigm, you know, that involved, frankly, egotism in another way, which was waving my fists and, you know, saying, well, this is right and this is wrong. It was a moralism from the other side. And it didn't have love in it because it was very judgmental of people who didn't disagree with me.
Okay, so let's move on to the next part of your book where you talk about finding love. And there's again, lovely stories in this. For example, living God's love in the desert, your encounter with Father Pavlos in the Sinai desert. And also, I liked all of the stories, but I especially liked the story that you about your encounter with Mona Polaca. Is that how you pronounce her name? Of the International Council of the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers. Maybe talk a little bit about those two and what those the role they played in finding love for you.
Yeah, well, Father Pavlos is a Greek Orthodox, he's now in his 80s, who has lived at the foot of Sinai in Egypt for about 40 or 50 years. He went there as a young person and to find God, and has lived there in a monastic context. And so that's a very solitudinous experience of being in a desert environment. And when I was with him, it was like I could hear the winds in the room. I mean, he's like a very ancient soul and a product of a very harsh desert environment, and yet the warmth and kindness that came through his eyes was so beautiful and comforting to be with. And he shared with me the practice of the Jesus Prayer, which is a Greek Orthodox contemplative method that's silently done with the breath and down deep into the heart. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. And that right there is very humbling and very loving, asking for mercy and praying to be a channel of mercy. So his training, even though he's a Greek Orthodox and they have very strict views about what's a proper Christian, yet their training is not to judge anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Not to judge anyone. And so that, and to just pray for mercy for everyone. So that helped me see the people that I disagree with quite differently. You know, instead of going after them or pointing out the ways in which we disagree, I can silently, in my own way, pray for their lives to be dealt with mercy, for them to have lives that are full of happiness and you know, a relief of suffering. And what a beautiful way just to go through life, whether you're in the desert or elsewhere. And then with Mona Palaka, I mean, a completely different paradigm. You know, she's Havasupai, Hopi, Tiwai, you know, Native American grandmother who doesn't live in the desert. She lives in Tucson and participates in all kinds of community around the world. She goes to different countries to speak at United Nations conferences on water rights and indigenous rights, so a very different path than Father Pavlos, and yet within the teaching is, again, this real, deep, genuine kindness toward everyone. And she told me her teaching is that even with those who have harmed her or been unkind to her, that she's not to give back harm or unkindness, but to really pray for them as a piece of life. I mean, everything that lives is a part of life, and we're all interconnected. So if you're unkind to something aside from yourself, then you're actually being unkind to yourself, because we're all of life. All of us share life, so we must be kind to all of life. And, of course, she deeply taught me. I mean, in the moment that we were sitting there outside in this beautiful park area, deeply taught me about the elements that we all share in common: air, water, earth, and fire.
Yeah. I had the honor of sitting with some Diné grandmothers a few years ago, just sitting because we didn't speak a common language. But even just being in their company, you know, being smiled at and having them talk amongst each other, and I could tell they were talking about me in a very, but in a kind way. I could feel that, you know, I could feel that. that was a really wonderful experience. So I'd like to.
The other thing that I learned from both of them was it's not only the words that we say or the actions. It's actually an energy that we have, you know, or even our thoughts. And this is something that Gandhi, of course, emphasized in his teaching on nonviolence, that it has to do with our thoughts, you know. So a practice of love eventually really is to become not only a non-harming person in our words and actions, but non-harming just in our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to move through life, and of course, you know, we can't help, you know, I mean, my gosh, I'm so far, I have so far to go in terms of what I'm talking about, but it is something I'm aware of that has shifted for me, been transformed over the years of working on this project, that the inner environment, you might say, of this human being that is speaking has gone through a transformation. It's not so full of anger and hateful thoughts and, you know, judgmentalisms. So over time with these practices and being around these loving environments and loving people, even our insides are worked on.
Yeah. And it works the other way around, too. I find myself, especially, you know, in the last, in the most recent period of my life, I find myself yelling at the radio. you know, I don't watch TV, thankfully, so I don't yell at the television, but I do yell at the radio sometimes. And then afterwards, I realize that didn't make me feel very good. And it wouldn't have made that person feel very good if they'd been in the room with me, you know. So why am I doing this?
Well, my teacher, Dr. Hawkins, you know, he was so wonderful because he just let me be natural, and he himself is natural. So we have these natural sort of emotions, up and downs. I mean, that's just normal. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of the day, you know, I always go back to my intention to be a kind and loving person, you know. I think the story of my book is really, in terms of the Fran story, it's this imperfect person who is looking and searching for something and finding something and trying to apply it the best I can, but really not being perfect and doing the best I can with what I've been given. What else can we do?
Right. Right, exactly. Let me take a moment to let our listeners know that you are listening to KZYX, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. This program is Wild Oak Living. I'm Johanna Wild Oak, and bring you this program every other Thursday from 11 until noon. And my guest today is Fran Grace, and we are talking about her book, The Power of Love, A Transformed Heart Changes the World. And it's basically a book of how would you describe it? It's a book about your journey, and it's a book of stories about people, right?
Yes, and it's a compendium of teachings on how to cultivate love and compassion. Teachings that are global in where they've been sourced and how they can influence.
Yeah, and you truly have, I think, stories from almost every part of the world, and we're moving through the book rather quickly and just picking, you know, one or two aspects of each chapter. But there are many people that you describe in the book. How about if you pick something from part three, Transformed My Love? What are some of the encounters there that you'd like to share with us in that part of your journey?
Yes, well, I'd like to highlight my experience there in Mendocino County.
Okay.
Because it was there unexpectedly, synchronistically, which of course is how the book unfolded.
Right.
Where I met Belvy Rooks and Dean Gills, who are the co-founders of Growing a Global Heart. And I was up there and had an encounter with a woman who lived in Albion named Sunlight, and she became a great teacher for me in a certain area of life. And she introduced me unexpectedly to Belvy and Deaton, who were the co-founders of Growing a Global Heart. And there we are in Queenie's Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're telling me about their story of going on their honeymoon to Ghana and going to Elmina's slave dungeon and on their honeymoon and standing in the dungeon in the very place where their own ancestors had been kidnapped and held enslaved and pushed through the door of no return. And in the weeping and the anger and all of that about the horrible violation that humans have done to each other, and for them, such a personal horror because of it's their own ancestors whose names are erased. And what a wound of erasure, is how Belvy put it to me, that how painful that is. And out of that story, which they could have had that experience and focused only on the anger and the bitterness, on everything that's wrong, and yet something within them at a deeper level was transformed, and their commitment as activists had been to, we've got to get to hope. We've got to get to hope. So out of their story came the founding of their organization, which is a vision of planting millions of trees in places of racial violence, and the tree ceremonies that they have done around the world, where people circle and they hold hands and they pray and they sing, and then they plant the tree. And the tree, they told me, is a powerful symbol of love for us because, of course, it's unconditional. I mean, a tree is a refuge for anybody that's walking by. Its branches have nests of all kinds of birds and even rats sometimes. You know, the tree doesn't say, I welcome you, but not you. The tree unconditionally gives itself. So Bellevue and Deedon, I met them there in Mendocino County and then had many blessed occasions to meet with them and be with them and learn from them.
And the tree is always there, it occurs to me. I'm surrounded by trees, and the most comforting thing for me about living among trees is that whenever I need to go see the tree, it's there. You know, it's
exactly.
Yeah. And that presence is just so steadying and anchoring and reassuring, and teaches you patience.
Right, exactly. And that, when I met with the Sufi teacher Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, and he wrote a beautiful foreword to the book, he gave me a teaching from the Sufi tradition that in cultivating love, the human being eventually will become that great, deeply rooted tree that's a refuge for anyone that needs a refuge. That we may, you know, a human being who's a loving human being, unconditionally loving, doesn't even have to go do any great deed according to the world, but just existing, deeply rooted, fully blossomed, like you're describing, just being that kind of presence within humankind, then is a great blessing and uplift to the whole world.
It seems like an especially important teaching in a world where we're all but many of us are so super mobile and always on the move. Even if we have a home that we've been in for a long time, most of the time we're on the move. And to get back to something that can teach us that kind of grounding and rootedness, like a tree, seems like an important concept.
Very much so.
Well, time's just flying, and we only have about 15 minutes or so left in our interview, and let's move to the part four of your book. The book is The Power of Love, and my guest is Fran Grace, who wrote this book, and it's about how a transformed heart changes the world. Surrendering to love. Now, surrender, that's a concept that is difficult, I think, for many of us. The whole concept of letting go and surrendering to something that's either inside or outside of you. I'm kind of a type A personality. I have a real problem with that. Although I don't have a problem, you know, surrendering, like lying under a tree and surrendering myself to that. But in terms of, you know, surrendering my life and surrendering my thoughts, that kind of thing. And can you talk a bit, first of all, what is that concept, surrendering, and then surrendering to love, and maybe share one or two stories from that that part of your journey in the book?
Mother Teresa had a famous quote where she said she was a pencil in the hand of God. So and this is something that I learned really from all the people that I interviewed, whether they were Buddhist or Hindu, or even the physicist from Stanford, William Tiller, a scientist. He was surrendered to be a channel of goodness and love in his science, because what we're talking about is just living from the highest part of ourselves. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about surrendering the lower aspects of ourselves to the higher aspects, and that really sums up the whole journey, you know, to move from egotism and greed and being driven by anger and I got to get this, I want this out of this, wanting something out of everything, or it's all about me, bringing, you know, all the attention about me, you know, just eventually seeing that that really doesn't actually make sense. Because it's creating a whole separateness between me and my life and between me and what I'm doing. And if we can surrender the grip that we have, where we have to prove something and get something and just see that really we're just here to offer something and to encourage life and to love life, we're surrendering to the higher part of ourselves, which then creates a feeling, a glorious, beautiful feeling of harmony with life itself. Because then we're acting more with one with life. And that makes it actually a lot easier to live that way. So for me, I'm not particularly a religious person at this point. But for me, the surrendering to love really, I guess you might say, it's like putting the wood into the fire. Putting the, you know, the log of my resentment about, oh, you know, my life went this way. I'm mad at my dad. I'm mad at my mom. I'm mad at my ex. Or, the, you know, mad at my colleagues at work. They don't recognize me. You know, you put in all those, that log of resentment in the fire. The fire is the fire of love. Putting in my greed. You know, I'm not personally taking profit from this book. All
yes,
the profits are going to the people that contributed to it, because really, I mean, they gave me everything. And so to put some personal need for financial profit, you know, put that into the fire, surrender that. It's a very simple thing, really. And then once we do that, we really have become a fire, a living fire. And that's, I guess, what I'm hoping for myself, that just like the people I interviewed, that I could just be simply a living fire that people will be warmed by and transformed by, because I was so transformed by being in their presence, because they had surrendered all these little logs of the lower self into the greater dimension of themselves, which is about love, it's about nobility, it's about selfless service, which really sounds intense, but it's the reality of life, that we're all a part of the same life. We all are, in a sense, selfless, because we're all united with each other.
Yeah. Thank you. That's beautiful. Beautifully described. I'm wondering if you could spend some time talking about Dr. David R. Hawkins and his wife, Susan Hawkins, who I think played a very, very important role in your life, and maybe spend some time talking about them and what they meant in the context of your journey and also in the context of this book.
Well, the book is dedicated to them. And I wasn't looking for a spiritual teacher. Honestly, it would have been the last thing, and especially a man, because at that time when I was 39, I was a very committed feminist. And in the sense, not, I guess you would say, in a rather zealous, extreme sense in my own mentality, because it meant for me very anti-male, because I had been so offended and oppressed by certain men in my religious system, and it made me very angry and hurt. And so a man, learning at the feet of a man, was the last thing I ever would have guessed. But this is the way love has worked on Fran. I had to love everything I thought was unlovable, see, because love is all-inclusive. And if we're committed to love, we have to love, eventually, anything that we have judged to be unlovable. So I had to love this older man. He was in his 70s, 80s, and he became a spiritual teacher for me and guided me. And his wife, Susan, was also a very important person to me, and is an important person to me because of her love. And in the encompassing love that I experienced with them all healed within me, those old wounds of insecurities, of self-rejections, in particular the being gay. That was a big deal for me, having grown up in my culture and early religious life. To be loved in the core nature of my own human loving was profoundly healing, and I am forever grateful to them both that they loved all of me. And I had the sense, you know, when you're with these great beings, you have the sense that they know every molecule, everything that you've ever done and that you'll ever do, and yet you're loved totally. This is the benefit of being around a true teacher. I won't say that it's necessary for everyone. What do I know? All I can say, it was beautiful and apparently necessary for me to have a spiritual teacher.
And it sounds like it was also, it healed a lot of your childhood wounds.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
There's a beautiful picture in the book, in the chapter where you talk about, where you talk about Dr. Hawkins and Susan Hawkins, where he's talking to you and he's asking your questions and you're answering his questions. It's just a really beautiful picture. Also, the book of Dr. Hawkins and his wife are sitting on stage, and the way he looks at her with this amazing love in his eyes. Such a sweet picture. There's one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, which plays an important role in your book, and that's the role of dreams in your life and how dreams have been guiding you and guiding you. And I'm wondering if we could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, good. That's a great thing to talk about, because pretty much everybody has dreams, and so it's a real connection between us and the listeners. People are interested in their dreams, and for me, I became interested in my dreams when I had an encounter with a Jungian analyst, that is, a person who's a psychotherapist who's done the training to become certified in the dream techniques of Carl Jung, C.G. Jung, the famous Swiss psychiatrist. And I myself have been in Jungian analysis now for about 7 or 8 years, and also in the Sufi tradition that Llewellyn von Lee is the successor of. I've learned a lot in working with dreams, because we do that in the Sufi groups. But for me, dreams are a help, because when the ego is asleep at night, there's something still going on, and something can come through from our depths into our consciousness if we honor it, if we're willing to say, okay, maybe there's something here for me to look at. Unpleasantly, oftentimes for me, it was seeing a shadow side of myself, you know, a greedy part of my nature, or in my case, a lot, you know, a tendency to be very spiritually arrogant, inflated about myself. So in some of my dreams, I was doing grand things and showing off, you know, psychic gifts or something like that. Mm-hmm. or moving through my life in a rushed way, driving a car and hitting all these people and not caring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what does that say about myself? Mm-hmm. Well, I had to, you know, you have to look at that. You know, how do I do that in my life? How is this showing up in present day? And then there are also beautiful visitations, you might say, from people who have passed on that were very loving for us. You know, a grandparent or a spiritual teacher might show up. I mean, people have dreams where they have the face of a person that they don't recognize, and then one day, a couple years later, they see the face on the cover of a book, and it's Sadhguru.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, dreams have many different levels. You know, there are shadow dreams that show us these rejected parts of ourselves that we need to integrate and incorporate. There are dreams that might be classified as actual spiritual experiences. I had a friend tell me recently that she had a dream. She had had a very upsetting day at work, and that night she had a dream where her teacher appeared to her and was taking her into his arms and holding her and infusing her with total compassion. Mm. So she felt like, even though she had had a really rough day where she unraveled emotionally, that she's being held by a deeper force of love.
That's a wonderful dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you have dreams that answer questions for you and that guide you, do those come just out of the blue, or do you, when you go to bed at night, ask for answers, or do you have like kind of a ritual around dreaming?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when I started off, I wasn't connected to my psyche. Yeah, I lived a lot just out of my conscious day-to-day life, and to sort of open up, being willing to say, wow, maybe there's something else in me that I can be connected to, then to set an intention is very nice, you know, to say, okay, you know, I'm going to sleep now. It'd be nice to know something that I need to know right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm open. And then I have a journal where I write down things, because if they're not written down and given some attention, then they're lost. We get a lot of hints all day that we ignore.
Right.
So part of being on a path of love is to be open to teachings about love wherever they might come from, the hints. You know, I mean, we've had here beautiful butterflies flying through the garden for the last 2 days, and they're on their great migration. And they're so beautiful. There is such a hint of love in the atmosphere. So just taking a moment to see them fly and make their great journey, and what can I take from that about my path of love?
Yeah. Every little thing in your environment can act as a reminder about that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we have about 2 minutes left before we unfortunately have to end this interview. So I would like to invite you to share anything I haven't asked you about, or any contact or website information or anything that you'd like to share with us.
Well, I just want to say thank you. It's been wonderful to be with you, and I appreciate your questions, and I appreciate who's ever been listening as an encouraging presence. And yes, the website is www.innerpathway.com, and thank you so much, and good luck with your program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for being on Wild Oak Living today. This has been a very inspiring conversation, and I hope our listeners found it that way as well. I'd like to end with a poem from the epilogue of your book, and I don't know, do you want to read it, or should I read it? The one that's
go ahead.
Okay, the life, and this is by Elizabeth Cheatham.
Right.
The life, the path, in pain or joy, a solidarity pilgrim lights the way. I'm sorry, a solitary pilgrim lights the way. I'm not a good poem reader. Each step emerges from the stillness and falls back into the silence, casting no shadow and leaving no footprint, creating universes outside of time, moving in and through with grace and case. I'm sorry, with grace and ease, a solitary pilgrim along the way, the path, my life, in pain and joy.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much again, and all the best for your journey. And again, the website is innerpathway.com.
Mm-hmm.
Innerpathway.com. My guest has been Fran Grace. She's the author of a book called The Power of Love, A Transformed Heart Changes the World. Thank you so much, and thank you for writing this beautiful book.
Thank you. Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. I will be back in 2 weeks. And the topic 2 weeks from now is going to be part two of the my series this year about how to prepare for and stay safe during wildfires. And this second program on March 28th from 11 until noon is going to be about fire safe councils, and also we're hoping to have somebody from CAL FIRE on that program. So tune in for that 2 weeks from now, March 28th from 11 until noon, and next week it's going to be the Cannabis Hour. Coming up is Fresh Air, and support for KZYX comes from our members and the Lighthouse Peddler. The Lighthouse Peddler is the monthly guide to music, events, theater, film, arts, poetry, and life in the Mendocino Coast, plus original writing on books, wellness, ocean conservancy, and more. The March issue is now available at locations from Jenner Point to Arena and online at thelighthousepeddler.com. You are listening to KZYX Philo 90.7 FM, KZYZ Willits and Ukiah at 91.4 5 FM, and Fort Bragg at 88.1 FM. We are Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. We're also found on Facebook, and we stream live at kzyx.org. Check out our website, too. There's lots of local and national news and stories and news reports here from the radio station on our website, kzyx.org. You can also listen live online there. And then also check out our jukebox. If any of the programs that you hear on KZYX aren't airing at a time when you can listen to them, like maybe even this program, if you've heard friends talking about how they can't listen to it at 11 o'clock, well, jukebox.kzyx.org is where you can listen to programs anytime. Most programs are up there for about 2 months, the public affairs programs, music programs a little bit less long, but that's where you can go and check out all the programs that you might have missed. And now